Good morning. I hope you're well. Last week I was having coffee and then I wanted to chat about a couple of things I was doing. So I turned on my camera, did a short talk, and I thought to myself, this would be fun to do on a more regular basis. You know, make myself a morning coffee and talk about some things that either I'll be talking about in more depth on my Patreon, or just stuff that I probably won't be talking about, or maybe I'll be writing about, whatever, in the future. And so I'm going to experiment with making myself a morning coffee and talking about some ideas. See how that goes. So hopefully this is enjoyable. So what did I want to do today? Well, part of the idea for these morning reflections is to be inspired by stuff that I'm seeing online and maybe wanting to respond to. And something that I've seen this week, and I see this all the time with some of my colleagues, are people who are often attacking evangelical Christianity. You can tell sometimes that there is a real enjoyment out of the attack, although it's maybe an attack based on morality and ethical reasons. And I want to talk a little bit about enjoyment, but not in this video, but I think the next one or one in the future, I do want to talk about how we get enjoyment and how we need to become aware of where we get our enjoyment. You know, if we're enjoying scapegoating, making an enemy, it's all the better whenever they deserve it, because then we can really hide our enjoyment. But it's important sometimes to look at where do we get our enjoyment and become aware of that, because sometimes if you, like a bully, for example, might get enjoyment from obviously bullying somebody. But if the bully is then able to find people who they think deserve to be bullied, they can feel that they are moral in doing that. But what happens is the bully really requires someone to bully, because there's an enjoyment they're getting out of it. And the enjoyment is the solution to a problem. There's some reason that some trauma that is being dealt with through this activity. And until you start to do the work of looking at what you're getting out of something, you may not never get to the point of working out why you need what you're doing. And that is what I want to talk about this morning. Because something, and this will partly be a critique of analytic philosophy a tiny bit in its popular forms, and I will potentially use some technical language occasionally, but I will explain most of it as I go along. So there's a lot of people out there who critique things in terms of the level of belief, and they look at things empirically. And they try to work out whether it's rational, say, to believe in God or to believe in Christianity or whatever it is. And this is very popular. There's actually a guy that I really like called Alex. I think Alex O'Connor used to be called Cosmic Skeptic. And he's a young guy, smart, and I followed him for a long time. And he's become really, really big. And, you know, his work, I think, is becoming more perceptive and deeper as he goes. But you'll notice that so much of what he does is at the level of, you know, whether a belief is rational or irrational, and he has in the past debated people like William Lane Craig, or discussed, I should say. He's very respectful, and he discusses these themes. But what is often overlooked is the function of religion for people. And this is deeply important. So I want to talk a little bit about that. And this is not just about religion. This is about anything. The function of the type of job you have, the type of activities and hobbies you have. So you can do what I'm going to do here with anything. And this is almost talking about how do we become more reflective about ourselves? How do we become more curious about our own unconscious? This is actually another plug, what my Spark retreat is about. It's about helping people become aware of the function of the various things that they do, how those things are solutions to certain problems, and how to unpack those problems. And I'm going to use some concrete examples as I talk. I'm actually going to use an example of a success and an example of a failure. So whenever I talk about religion in terms of not its beliefs, but its function, what I want to talk about briefly is the idea that all of us, from a kind of proper psychoanalytic perspective, all of us are distorted. To be human, there is no normal. So one of the critiques of mental health used to be called the anti-psychiatry movement and is developed, but one of the critiques of mental health is that there is this idea that there is a pre-traumatic subject. The subject undergoes trauma, and you can get to a post-traumatic subject. Also, mental health often means how to be better adapted to your environment, how to be better adapted to your work and your relationships. So there's always this sense of it's normative and it's very value-laden. It's how to kind of like integrate better into the world, which is fundamentally not what psychoanalysis is about. So it's a very different type of, you might say psychoanalysis isn't even a therapy in the strict sense of the term. It grew out of therapy and there are therapeutic elements of it, but it grows out of a fundamental insight from Freud that kind of critiqued therapy called death drive. Mm. But if you take this idea then that there is no mental health as such, that we're all distorted. And broadly speaking, you can say that people are distorted in terms of whether they're neurotic, perverse, psychotic, and potentially autistic, right? So those are potentially four ontological structures, which means there are four ways in which people engage with desire, with pleasure, with language. And so a neurotic and a psychotic actually get enjoyment in different ways, and they engage with the world in slightly different ways, right? So there's these four structures. Now, when it comes to something like religion, religion can often be the solution to the set of problems that arise from one of these structures. So, for example, a neurotic person might deal with a lot of anxiety. So neurotic individuals often are very experience anxiety, and the anxiety comes from where do I fit into the desire of the other? What does the other desire of me? Do I evoke their desire? Or if someone else evokes their desire, how do they evoke their desire and I don't? Right. So there's a real question for the neurotic about where they fit into the desire of the other. And that can create a certain amount of anxiety. So for young people, they often, one of the ways to bind the anxiety is through private rituals, obsessive rituals, when not walking in the cracks, touching taps a certain amount of time, turning lights off and on, whatever it is. And religion can sometimes be a way to bind anxiety through a shared set of rituals that kind of again bring a certain peace to that person. So there's beliefs and what they think, but also the religion is offering a solution to a problem. For a perverse subject, the issue is what's called a failure of the paternal function, which means that for the perverse subject, they experience themselves and they get their desire from being the object that fully satisfies the other. They think they can satisfy the other. And they have the perverse subject doesn't have much space for their own desire. They're so caught up in the enjoyment of the other and how they can, as I say, be the solution to that person's lack. And religion for a perverse subject can sometimes be a way of what's called propping up the paternal function. And what that means is religion can be a way to bring a certain separation from the primary caregivers. By embracing religion, it's a way of separating them from their family in order to be able to have a space for their own desire separate from the family unit. And then thirdly, for a psychotic subject, a religion can be a way to who there's a fundamental absence of what's called the paternal function, which is the function that separates you from the what's called the first other, which is often the maternal other, often the mother. There's a way in which we separate to become subjects, to enter into the world. This happens in two stages, alienation and separation. In alienation, you realize that you and the first other are not one. And then separation is when you realize that the other is full of desires for things that are different from you, separate from you. Right, they desire work, they desire a partner, they desire other things. And so the first stage, which is called alienation, is you feel yourself separate from the other, but you want to be the solution to that separation. You want to reunite. And so you try to find how you can be the answer to the other's lack, to kind of like reunite with them. In separation, you realize you can't be everything for the other, because they have other desires and their own desires are unknown to them. And then you have to go and get what's called substitute satisfaction, symbolic satisfaction. So in a very pragmatic level, it's like, you know, in a family, the father might basically say, listen, you can't stay with your mother forever. You have to separate. But you know what? Go and you learn how to box or hunt or run or whatever and get symbolic success, you know, get you know, that's why in schools you get awards for things, and you know, you kind of, it's not as good as the incestuous relationship with the mother other, but as a substitute satisfaction, and you enter into the symbolic world. Well, for the psychotic subject, there's a sense in which that separation has not happened, so their religion can be a way to, as an artificial paternal function, an artificial way to bring a type of separation. Now, the reason why I'm saying all of this is that if you're just, you know, arguing about someone's religion, say they're a fundamentalist and you disagree with that, and you're just trying to prove to them why they're wrong, but you're not asking the question, what is this the solution to? Is this providing a way to bind their anxiety, to prop up the paternal function, to have a certain separation that is needed to avoid a psychotic break? Then one is you're not going to get very far, right? And two is if you're successful, that's even worse. That's going to cause a catastrophe, right? That what we need to do for ourselves, not just for the other, but for ourselves, is to work out what is the function of what I do. Even if it's always critiquing evangelicals, what is that the solution to? What is that? What are you reenacting and needing to reenact in order to kind of bind your anxiety? So I want to give a couple of examples. One is, these are both people I know and know well. One is a young guy who, when he was about 18, he was a very strong creationist, converted into Christianity, embraced various beliefs, including creationism. And he would argue with people. He read all of the books of the creationists, and he would argue with anybody he could, people who knew a lot more about geography and cosmology than he did. But he had all of these arguments. And what was interesting was there was an event that happened where he was in church, and he was talking to an elder in that church. And he said to the elder about creationism, was talking to the elder about creationism. Now, interestingly, this elder may have believed in creationism himself, but he put his hand on this guy's shoulder and said, listen, I don't think it matters that much. And immediately the entire edifice of that belief collapsed. Immediately. And he started to kind of like see all the arguments that had been given 100 times before against what he was saying. He started to kind of like see it all fell into place. So what was happening there? Well, for this guy, there was a sense in which religion was a way of propping up the paternal function. It enacted a separation. Alienation had happened, but separation hadn't happened. So there was, within this guy, always a sense of being the object of the other's pleasure, whether it was the parental other or then in any adult relationship, that he defined himself solely in terms of being the object of the other's pleasure. In other words, he didn't really desire anything for himself except for that, and that's how he got his enjoyment. But religion was a way to temporarily prop up the paternal function, the separation. And creationism in particular did this. So creationism is all about separation, separating the night from the day, male from female, the animals from the humans, right? All the separation that happens in this creation story. And so by embracing this creation story, he was propping up the separation. It was doing something. Now, this elder also had a paternal function for this individual. It was like a father figure. So when this father figure said, I don't think it matters that much, he was able to find a healthier solution to propping up the paternal function, right? The healthier solution was he looked up to this guy. Guy was a good guy. I knew him. So a good father figure, right? So was able to still prop up the paternal function with this male, older male leader, and not use the creation story and this kind of, fundamentalist scientific perspective in order to function. So in that example, if you just took away the creationism without finding a different and healthier way to do the function, something kind of negative can happen. And this is where I come to another example, which is a friend who, we'll call him John. He was an evangelical Christian. And a very, very committed one, charismatic evangelical, doing lots of evangelism. He's preaching on the streets, really, really into it. And I remember discussing with him on numerous occasions things about faith. This is when I was very young as well. And there was a point where one time, I remember it very well, I was in Lakeel Street, where I used to live, and we were arguing and discussing, and he just looked at me, very fiery way. He says, Pete, I need religion. And this was just one phrase in the midst of like a 3-hour conversation. But it really struck me even then, when this is before I had much training in psychoanalysis, et cetera, et cetera. But I knew that that was very significant. Not just what he said, but the way he said it. There was like everything within him said this, I need religion. And also it came out so differently from everything else, right? So everything else was apologetics, rational reasons for his belief. So this came out as a type of slip. It was an eruption of something that he didn't even notice himself. It's just like, I need this. Now, what happened, and he was someone who suffered from psychotic symptoms. And what happened for him a number of years later is he lost his evangelical religion in a very dramatic way through a series of events, a series of failures. But he didn't have anything to replace the function, right? So he had a psychotic break. He left his family, he ran away, disappeared for years, ran off to a different country. I got to see him one final time, interestingly. And he eventually, very, very sadly, took his own life. He did try to find another solution, and he tried to find another solution with the sexual community, a sex community, that where he was able to enact separation, but it didn't hold. It wasn't strong enough. And to say, he ended up taking his own life because the struggles and the darkness was too much. So I use these examples to talk about how, for ourselves and for the people that we're talking to, religion is not just a set of beliefs that can to be critiqued and be discussed. Yes, it is, but it can also provide a function. And coming to know, which takes a lot of work, coming to know what that function might be for us or be for the person that we're talking to, And then working out, are there healthier ways to find a solution to the problem that that is solving, right? And beginning to, and so it might be, for example, through writing or becoming a movie director or taking up some other hobby or love, right? Or whatever, right? There's various ways in which you can find a solution and find solutions that are better. But if you kind of go with the idea that we can't, there's no post-traumatic subject, so there's no way of just being kind of inverted commas normal, that we all have certain things that we're lacking and certain solutions to that, then it's more about working out what our current solutions are, whether they're working for us. And the reason why people go into therapy generally is because the solutions that they had are no longer working. They're no longer giving the enjoyment that they used to give. They're no longer binding the anxiety. And actually, in therapy, one of the dangers is that the individual just wants their symptom to start working again. And, you know, in bad therapy, that's kind of what you try to do. But in good analysis, what you try to do is not just get the old symptom to start working again, is to help the person find other ways to find the solution to the problem. And one of the reasons why analytic philosophy, I think, is very bad at this is because analytic philosophy doesn't take seriously, in general, negation. So analytic philosophy actually was born pretty much out of a rejection of Hegel, out of a rejection of Hegel's idea of negation. And that means that in analytic philosophy, you don't generally find them taking seriously the unconscious, because the unconscious is negation at the level of the subject, right? Is this lack. What you find is analytic philosophers will go for things like neuro-linguistic programming, cognitive behavioral therapies, or depth psychology, or they'll maybe embrace a Jungian unconscious because that's a positive thing, not a negative. But the idea of this negation isn't something that is generally explored in analytic philosophy. So what you do is you get this one level dialogue about whether a belief is rational or not. You don't kind of explore how we're riven with some sort of traumas as subjects and our religious, as well as our work and our love life, reflect our ways of attempting to cover over, respond to those traumas of our lives. And therefore, the whole discourse is, as I say, is unsuccessful at best and successful at worst. And I'm thinking of one person in particular who you've just seen on Instagram a lot, but who is always trying to attack conservatives, evangelicals, and mock them and, you know, gets enjoyment out of it, you know. So you can go like, well, they're not finding much success, which is good, because if they were actually able to strip away the function that religion maybe is giving these people without kind of exploring that and finding other solutions, then it can be catastrophic for individuals. And that's why, like in my work, for example, it's providing a space for people to ask that question, providing a space for people to become curious with not just the rational content of their beliefs, which is very interesting, but become curious about what function that might have played. You know, when did you say, if you're religious, when did you embrace that? What age were you? And was that a way to bring separation between you and your family? Was that a way of avoiding a psychotic break? Was it a way of binding a certain anxiety around sexuality or whatever? And begin to go, oh, ah, right. And as you work that out, you're actually more able to be rational about your beliefs and pick them through and think about them. But you kind of have to start by asking yourself what's going on within it. Okay, so that's just some thoughts I wanted to share with you. I think I want to do one on enjoyment soon as well. So if you like these, please do let me know, because if you do like these, I will start doing them on a more regular basis. Okay, have a great day. Bye-bye.